Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, The Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning appointment, please call 919-779-1755. This program is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's trivia questions come to us from the websites onthisday.com and thecollector.com. Question number one, what happened to piano keyboards in the 18th century? Was it A, the black keys became white and the white keys became black? Was it B, the keyboard shrank in size from 124 keys to the current 88 key total? Was it C, ivory was forbidden in the construction of keys on the keyboard? Was it D, all of the above are true about 18th century piano keyboards? Or was it E, none of the above is true about 18th century piano keyboards? So what were piano keyboards like in the 18th century anyway? And question number two, what happened to Elvis on this very day back in 1960? Was it A, he ripped his pants open while demonstrating his karate skills? Was it B, he started dyeing his hair jet black? Was it C, he joined the U.S. Army? Or was it D, he was burned in effigy by angry crowds of conservatives? So, on this day in 1960, Elvis, what was it all about anyway? The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from that same website, onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of December the 6th. It was on this very day back in 1865 that composer Johann Sibelius was born. Sibelius is known for such compositions as Finlandia. His B-Day? Today, born in 1865, and it was 61 years ago today, 1963, that Frank Sinatra Jr. was kidnapped. He was released after a $240,000 ransom was paid. Kidnapped today, back in 1963. Franz Liszt's Hungarian Rhapsody introduces our classical music news. It's titled A Thousand Wild Concerts, How Liszt Invented the Piano Recital and Became a 19th Century Pinup. This is published in Classical Music, BBC Music Magazine, on the 29th of August, 2024. On 9 June 1840, a year or so into his European tour, Liszt hosted the first of two London concerts, advertised as Liszt Pianoforte Recitals at the Hanover Square Rooms in Mayfair. The piano recital was born. This was the first time the word recital had been used in terms of music. Until then, the word recital had only been used to describe dramatic readings, which is perhaps why Liszt was drawn to the word. In the past, his solo concerts bore the curious name Musical Soliloquies. Liszt was back on the touring circuit as a pianist in 1839 to help fundraise for a statue of Beethoven in Bonn. He had just emerged from an intense period of composition and was alarmed to hear that plans for the statue were under threat through lack of financial support. For his London appearance, Liszt put together a program that combined his own works with transcriptions of well-known masterpieces. This included his own arrangements of Beethoven's symphonies and Schubert's songs. Following his time in London, Liszt took a short break before returning to England in August to start a nationwide tour. The schedule was punishing, 50 concerts in 6 weeks. "My traveling circus begins today," he wrote to his lover from his first stop on the tour. The circus continued for about 8 years. By the time he'd finished, Liszt had given 1,000 concerts right across Europe. Liszt turned the usual form of a concert on its head. He interacted with the audience and spoke to them in between pieces. He often arranged the audience seats so he could move between them and chat to his fans. The programmed works would be used as the basis for spontaneous improvisations, too. These became something of a party trick and had a tendency to whip the crowd up into a frenzy. And to give his audience a better view and sound, he positioned the piano sideways on stage. All of this turned Liszt into a rock star, and a new trend began to sweep across Europe. The term Listomania was coined by the writer Heinrich Heine in 1844, in his report on the hysteria surrounding Liszt in concert. How convulsively his mere appearance affected them! How boisterous was the applause which rang to meet him! A veritable insanity! If Paganini had blazed a trail in the 1820s and 30s, it was Liszt who was now considered the greatest living virtuoso. Caricatures from the time depict him with long, spindly fingers playing without music, something audiences weren't used to seeing. But he wasn't just a showman. He was also something of a sex symbol, with female admirers collecting his cigar butts, coffee grounds from his cups, and locks of his hair. After his London performance, the concept of a musical recital began to be used to describe any solo concert. Piano manufacturers were soon sponsoring soloists, which helped give musicians an aura of celebrity. And that, in turn, paved the way for the piano's golden age. And in music research and technology, we have this article titled "Music is Hope. Holocaust survivor Saul Dreyer formed a band to comfort others." Music has the ability to crack open hearts, to change minds, to heal, to comfort. When I was 89, I read about the concert pianist Alice Hertz Selmer, who had died at 110. Like me, she was a Nazi concentration camp survivor. And also like me, she had used music as a way through that terrible time. After the war, she continued to play to try to heal hearts. I felt that I needed to honor her in some way. It came to me that I should organize a Holocaust survivor band to continue her work. I told my wife, and she said I was crazy. I told my rabbi, and he said I was crazy too. But I was very stubborn. During World War II, I was sent to several concentration and work camps in Poland. My whole family was killed, and I alone lived. There was a famous cantor in one of the camps with me, and he would sing Jewish songs. And in those moments of music, I found escape. One day, I realized that he needed a beat, so I managed to get two metal spoons, and I drummed for him, pum, pum, pum. Almost every night, we would all gather and sing, even though we were starving and exhausted. That is how I learned the drums. When we were liberated, I was sent to a displaced persons camp in Italy, where there were actual instruments. I played the drums for the people in the camp and the towns. Such joy. After I went to America between work and raising a family, I didn't have time for music. But reading about Alice Hertz Selmer brought me back to the way music can reach hearts. I bought some drums for my band idea. At first, my wife said, "Either the drums go or you go." But when you've been married so long, you fight for 5 minutes and make up 10 minutes later. Through people at my temple in Florida, I found other survivors and their children. Our first concert in 2014 was at the temple. We played Jewish, Polish, Hebrew, and dancing music. We got a standing ovation. I felt like the sky had opened. And my wife, she said, "I lived with you 51 years, and today you are a celebrity." In 10 years, we played all over America, including the White House, Israel, Canada, Brazil, and Poland. I will play for as long as I can, because music is hope. I am not interested in politics or taking sides. My purpose in life is to get people to see that we are all one. We all sing the same song. Anthropologists have written about how humans across cultures and throughout time have tended to develop rituals in an attempt to gain a sense of control over perceived uncertainty. So perhaps it's not surprising that even established musicians might resort to rituals prior to their performances. Alex Hopper, for example, writes in an October 24, 2024 article in AmericanSongwriter.com that many musicians have adopted pre-show superstitions. Hopper states that getting up on stage and performing in front of huge crowds is more than a daunting task. We could see why you would want to get as much help as you could, even if it's off base. So, the Rolling Stones' Start Me Up introduces our rock and pop music news. As an article from January 24, 2016 in mentalfloss.com about pre-show rituals notes, whether it's a matter of superstition or an attempt to create a sense of normalcy when sleeping in a new city every night, some of the world's biggest bands and musicians turn into creatures of habit while they're on the road. From shots of Jagermeister to wood-burning ceremonies, here are the pre-show rituals of some of your favorite artists. The Rolling Stones playing Start Me Up in the background now have a shepherd's pie ritual. Although the Rolling Stones have plenty of strange requests on their touring rider, such as cable or satellite television, so that they can watch cricket matches, one of the band's most bizarre requirements is a shepherd's pie for guitarist Keith Richards. The rock icon loves the dish and will not go on stage unless he's eaten one with an unbroken pie crust. He likes to be the first to break the crust himself. Richards once refused to perform when he discovered that the band's security team ate his shepherd's pie. He delayed the concert until a new one was made and served to him. Now that's rock and roll. And then there's the Foo Fighters. Foo Fighters listen and dance to Michael Jackson songs while taking shots of Jagermeister. Some bands pray to God they'll have the best show of their lives, explained frontman Dave Grohl. Some bands huddle in a rugby scrum and yell, "Go team!" We listen to Michael Jackson's Off the Wall and do Jager Bombs, which are Dave Lee Roth juice. If you want to be Dave Lee Roth on stage, you need at least 4 Jager Bombs to get you there. Then there's Rihanna's group rallying cry ritual. During Rihanna's tour in 2012, the pop star included an assortment of liquor and junk food on her tour rider, such as 1 package of Oreos and a box of Golden Graham cereal. She likes to drink Grey Goose vodka with fruit juice before taking the stage. But before every show, Rihanna huddles all of her backup dancers and musicians into a circle where they all lock hands in prayer and solidarity. Just before showtime, they put their hands in the middle of the circle and raise them to the ceiling as they yell out a rallying cry. And then there's Led Zeppelin's hot tea and ironing rituals. Although Led Zeppelin was known for being at the center of many outrageous tour shenanigans during the 1970s, including trashing hotel rooms and throwing TV sets out of windows, they've mellowed out over the decades. Instead of finding drugs, alcohol, or groupies backstage, frontman Robert Plant refers to get ready for a performance with a mug of hot tea and freshly pressed shirts and slacks that he ironed himself. And then there's John Legend's rotisserie chicken ritual. While on tour, John Legend sings for 2 hours straight for 5 days a week. Taking care of his vocals is his priority, so he stays away from alcohol and drinks plenty of water. The singer also eats half a rotisserie chicken before every performance. Then there's Beyoncé's prayers and massage chair rituals. In 2013, during her world tour, Beyoncé explained that in order to ease stress and help ensure a great performance, she spends a few hours relaxing before each show. "I say a prayer with everyone in the band, then we do a stretch," she said. "I sit in my massage chair while they do my hair and makeup, and I have an hour of peace, and I have a playlist that I listen to every day." And then there's Coldplay's group hug ritual. British rock band Coldplay believes in having a quiet moment before they step in front of tens of thousands of adoring fans. "Before we play live, we have a little moment where we're just quiet and have a supportive group hug," lead singer Chris Martin revealed. Then there's Leonard Cohen's whiskey and a Latin chant ritual. Before singer-songwriter Leonard Cohen takes the stage, he likes to prepare with a whiskey to calm his nerves. He also sings a Latin phrase as he walks to the stage with his backup singers and band. The phrase translates to, "I am poor, I have nothing." Finally, there's New Zealand's Lorde and her nap and berries rituals. Recording artist Lord prepares for a big show with a nap and a light meal of berries or seaweed. The New Zealander also admits that she gets really nervous before each performance, so sleeping with her lucky blanket and eating a small meal calms her down beforehand. Usually before a gig I have to sleep in my dressing room under a blanket I take everywhere with me, the 19-year-old singer told The Guardian. I eat some berries or some dried nori, which I get all over my face, in place of dinner, because a couple of hours before the performance, my stomach starts heaving and I feel like I'm going to throw up, even when I'm not that nervous. So how did you do on today's trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, what happened to piano keyboards in the 18th century? Was it A, the black keys became white, and the white keys became black? Was it B, the keyboard shrank in size from 124 keys to the current 88 key total? Was it C, ivory was forbidden in the construction of keys on the keyboard? Was it D, all of the above are true about 18th century piano keyboards? Or was it E, none of the above are true about 18th century piano keyboards? Correct answer? Answer A. The black and white colors of the keys were reversed. As noted in an article published in ClassicFM.com on May the 10th, 2024, titled, Why Are Piano Keys Black and White and When Did They Change? By Maddie Shaw Roberts. In the classical era, the colors on a piano keyboard were the other way around. The black keys were white and the white keys black. So when did it all change, and why are pianos made up of monochrome keys rather than, say, a vivid rainbow? Well, let's explore. On 18th century pianos, the black and white keys were reversed. A black keyboard with white accidentals as a clear way to separate the half tones from the whole tones. This was the case for any keyboard instruments, harpsichord, forte piano, or organ. The black keys were usually composed of rosewood or ebony, and the white keys made with ivory. In the 19th century, the size of the piano expanded and the instrument exploded in popularity. At the same time, the colors on its keyboard switched for reasons both functional and visual. The seven whole notes, or naturals, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, became the white keys, with the five halftones, or sharps and flats, on black keys in between. Whether black and white or white and black, separating the whole and half tones into repeating patterns of 12 notes makes it much easier for a pianist to play and to find the right notes on the full 88-key keyboard. Looking at a piano from Mozart's day, the black keys all seem to meld together, making it harder to see between the notes. Having the half-tone keys in black presents an image of stability to the eye. Dark lines between brighter white keys gave more visual clarity to the pianist looking at them at a glance, particularly while firing out Chopin's Etudes and the more complex solo piano repertoire of the Romantic era. Today, while the standard piano keyboards is white with black accidentals, there are some interesting variations out there. There's the piano in Japan with an all-white keyboard that can only play music in C major modes. Some piano makers have also played around with all-color keyboards, which might be a bit too much stimulation, when thundering out the Listian runs. And the answer to our second question, what happened to Elvis on this very day in 1960? Was it A, he ripped his pants open while demonstrating his karate skills? Was it B, he started dyeing his hair jet black? C, he joined the U.S. Army? Or D, he was burned in effigy by angry crowds of conservatives? Correct answer? Answer A, he ripped his pants open while demonstrating his karate skills. Turns out that it was on this very day back in 1960 that Elvis was visited at Graceland by the singer Fabian, who was known for such hits as Tiger. When Elvis's pants ripped open after demonstrating his karate skills, Fabian lent Elvis his pants. Elvis's jet black pompadour was world famous. However, it was partly an illusion. Elvis was, in fact, born blonde, and although his hair began to darken a little bit as he aged, it never got darker than light brown. Aspiring to look like his heroes, Tony Curtis and Marlon Brando, he began dyeing his hair black and continued to do so throughout his career. However, as a young teen, he couldn't always afford a dye job and had to make do with shoe polish. Those who opposed him and his style of music believed that the developing rock and roll genre was leading America's young people astray, corrupting them and exposing them to improper ways of life. With his wild dress, sexy good looks, and wild hip-thrusting dance move, Elvis was everything that conservatives hated about the genre. Angry crowds gathered in cities such as Nashville and St. Louis. Some even go so far as to burn effigies of the superstar in protest of his music and decorum. It turns out that it was also on this very day back in 1980 that Mark David Chapman shot John Lennon to death in New York City. Lennon had autographed an album for Chapman earlier that same day. Here, then, is Lennon's Imagine to close out today's program.
Imagine all the people living life in peace. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us, and the world will live as one.
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. This program's also available as a podcast after the broadcast in our website, ncreadingservice.org. As we leave you now, remember these words: kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. If you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me at 919-832-5138. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Music Review, underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning, please call 919-779-1755. So long, until next time.
Thank you.